Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we hear from two union workers who've been helping to man the picket line at the GM warehouse in Langhorne, Pennsylvania. The strike is now entering its fifth week. How are they faring? Also, the Reverend Renee McKenzie will join us. She's vicar of the Church of the Advocate in North Philadelphia, a glorious building built at the end of the 19th century. It's an essential part of the surrounding community, and it is in urgent need of repair. But first, we welcome Democratic Congressman Andy Kim to Radio Times. Kim represents New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District and is midway through his freshman term. He's just back from a trip to Afghanistan, Turkey, and the border of Syria and Jordan, part of a bipartisan delegation. We'll talk about this, as well as Kim's decision in recent months to join fellow Democrats in supporting the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. And we'll delve into some issues, if we have time, particular to the 3rd District. As always, if you've got questions or comments, here's the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Congressman Andy Kim, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So your most recent town hall meeting was on Saturday. Afghanistan was a major source of conversation. We should mention that you are a member of the House Armed Services Committee. And of course, President Trump wants to pull the, I think it's about 14,000 troops stationed in Afghanistan. Do you see this happening anytime soon?
In terms of pulling the troops out of there? Well, it's certainly a big concern that I heard, and I'm sure people in Afghanistan right now are wondering what's going to happen given how they saw the president act on Syria-Turkey issues in terms of the hasty withdrawal and reckless withdrawal of our troops there. You know, it was a very powerful experience to go out and visit Afghanistan, visit our troops there. I had worked there 8 years ago. I got to see my old office, my old desk. And sadly, I also heard a lot of the same points being made about where things stand. It's hard to see where the progress is moving forward. And given the fact that this past week was the 18th year anniversary of the war, I saw American armed service men and women there who couldn't have been much older than my 4-year-old on September 11th, now out there fighting for our future. And I wanted to have a conversation with my district about this. It's a district with a joint military base. We have people from the base deployed out to the Middle East right now. I met someone out in Kabul who's from the McGuire Air Force base area. So, you know, this is a community that understands the impact of this war, and it's very important that we pay attention to this and take the decisions that we need to be able to bring it to an end.
So peace talks last month between the U.S. and the Taliban ended when a U.S. soldier was killed. Should those talks resume?
Well, there's no military solution to the problem in Afghanistan right now. And that is something that I hear from our ambassador, from our military commanders, from Afghans themselves. There needs to be a negotiated political settlement if we are to have any chance at sustained peace in Afghanistan. I was critical of the direct talks between the United States and the Taliban. The Taliban did not want to have the Afghan government in the room because they don't recognize the legitimacy of the Afghan government. And I thought it was a wrong move for the United States to give in to the Taliban demand and talk with them in a bilateral way without the legitimate Afghan government involved. So I think those are the types of things that further delegitimizes the Afghan government, emboldens the Taliban, and makes it all the more harder to have the intra-Afghan peace talks that we so badly need.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, then you're not comfortable perhaps with talks between the U.S. and the Taliban resuming Afghanistan's in the room.
I would want to see the Afghan government in the process there. Now, they just had a presidential election right before I arrived there. That's going to take some time to sort out. But whoever wins that and comes forward needs to be at the table, needs to be part of this solution. You know, otherwise, well, we're not going to have a chance for lasting peace.
So again, as part of your trip you also went to Syria, the Syria-Jordan border and Turkey. And all this comes as, of course, President Trump decided to remove U.S. forces from the border of Turkey and Syria. The Kurds have been bombarded. What are the long-term ramifications, in your opinion, of this?
Well, I'll start with the short term because it moves into the long term. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we see the fact that there are ISIS detainees that are and ISIS sympathizers that are able to break out of these prisons. You know, 11,000 ISIS detainees in Syria that were being guarded by the Kurds. This is a huge strategic blunder that's going to put a lot of our gains against ISIS at risk. I worked at the National Security Council on the counter-ISIS fight early on. I saw how much effort and difficulty went in to be able to make the gains that we have, and to just put that all at risk and at jeopardy in such a hasty withdrawal without the type of strategy that is needed is so reckless and so devastating. So there's that angle of it. It's going to potentially embolden ISIS and potentially would give them opening to regain their foothold. But the other thing I'll say is that on a longer, more strategic level, it really brings into question what America's word is about, what our leadership is all about, and whether or not allies and partners from around the world can trust us. And when that credibility is at stake and the partnerships and the alliances that we build are brought into question, that could have ramifications all over the world.
And yet there are some who would say, why does the U.S. need to be fighting a number of wars on several fronts in other parts of the world? At what point do we bring our young men and women home?
And that is a very legitimate question to ask, a question that I ask all the time, a question that brought me to Afghanistan, both to serve 8 years ago as well as to the revisit as a member of Congress. And we owe it to our armed servicemen and women to give them clarity of mission and be able to make that promise to them that we will not keep them or deploy them or keep them in harm's way unless absolutely necessary to our national security. We went to Afghanistan because of September 11th, and we have a vital national interest to continue to ensure that it does not become a safe haven for terror from which people can plot attacks against our homeland right now. We see the same concerns, which was what brought us in back into the Middle East to fight ISIS, was the concern that that they would try to attack us. We have to stay focused on those interests. I understand that we are not going to be all over the world and trying to solve all the problems out there, but we can't lose sight of those vital national interests that we do have that protect our national security. And that's what I hope we focus in on.
Very quickly, any immediate aid that the U.S. can provide to the Kurds somehow?
There are a lot of limited steps that can be taken given the speed in which the Trump administration has moved to be able to withdraw all of our troops. I mean, the fact that we hear these reports of high-value ISIS detainees that weren't able to be transferred properly because our forces are being told to pull out so quickly. So right now, the best we can try to do is figure out what is it we can do to at least try to secure some of the ISIS detainees. But other than that, there's not a whole lot of options out there, and that's what makes this such a devastating and disappointing development.
Let's get to the impeachment inquiry. You hold town halls, I think it's once a month.
And that's right. We've done 13 town halls now in about 9 months or so.
Yeah, and early months. On, before you decided to join fellow Democrats in the impeachment process, there were members of your base who said, you really need to get on the bandwagon here. And now that you are with your fellow Democrats in the impeachment inquiry process, there are a couple of folks on Saturday who questioned you and said, well, is this really the right path? What was your response to them?
Well, as you said, we hold town halls at least once a month, and these are the cornerstone of what we're trying to do in the district is make sure we can really engage with the members of the community moving all over the district in terms of holding these town halls.
The district is, Burlington leans left, Ocean County leans right. So and the seat can actually flip back and forth between Democrats.
Well, it certainly is a district that has a lot of different opinions,
yeah.
Very diverse. And that's exactly what I need to hear. So when someone comes to a town hall like they did on Saturday and tells me their perspective, even if it's on something I disagree with, I first off by just say thank you. We need to be able to have discussions with each other with respect and civility. At one point, I quoted this line that I often do, which is Martin Luther King from the "I Have a Dream" speech that says, "Let us not try to quench our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred." So first and foremost, let's have a conversation about that. I'm happy to listen to different points of views. And, you know, on oversight, on impeachment, you know, certainly there are divided opinions about that very much as well. For me, what I said is that we have to keep this focused in on our national security. We have to approach this with a level of professionalism that doesn't even have a whiff of partisanship. Otherwise, we're not going to have the credibility. We're not going to be able to make the case and be able to focus in on what it is that's actually at stake, which is whether or not our Constitution and our Constitution, the duty to protect and serve the Constitution, was violated.
Let's quickly talk about an issue before the 3rd District. Flood insurance, a portion of the 3rd, was walloped by Superstorm Sandy 7 years ago. Can't believe it's been that long. So some legislation, I should say, is pending. What does this look like? How would it serve those in your district who live down the shore?
That's right. There's legislation ahead on flood insurance that moved out of the Financial Services Committee. I understand everyone knows we need to find a way forward on flood insurance, but the way forward that is being proposed right now by Democratic leadership and Republican leadership just isn't good enough for our district. You know, it allows premiums to be able to increase over 20%. It doesn't put into place some of the protections that consumers, that people have, need to have, given that how many of them were scammed or there was abuse of power from contractors and from insurance companies and other things like that that we need to be able to fix. So the New Jersey delegation, in a bipartisan way, working with other, again, bipartisan senators and members of Congress, have put forward our own legislation. We really hope that this can come up for a decision and that we can show that there's a way that we can do this that better protects our families that live in our communities who are really struggling. And I just, you know, heard from another person in my community who still says she's not back home after Superstorm Sandy.
Really?
And those are the types of things that just devastate me. And she's living in a campsite, she said. And it just boggles my mind that we're not able to be able to help solve these problems for folks.
Andy Kim, you are close to the midpoint of your first term in Congress. How would you describe the experience so far? High points, frustrations? We've got about 40 seconds left.
If I were to describe in one word when people ask me, I say it's humbling. It's a very humbling experience being able to walk into the United States Capitol and work on behalf of my district. It's humbling to represent my home district where I went to kindergarten and represent 750,000 people, three of which are my two little kids, my two-year-old, my four-year-old, and my wife. And it's also a very humbling experience working a job whose job description is written in the Constitution of the United States. And that's something that I think about every single day, and I hope to be able to do that with honor and integrity.
So in my hearing, it's very early, but you hope to do that with honor and integrity past 2020?
I'll do it as long as the voters of the Jersey 3rd give me the great opportunity to do so.
There you go. Democratic U.S. Congressman Andy Kim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me
today.
He
represents New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District. Up in just a moment here on Radio Times, we'll be talking to two workers who are on the picket line at the GM Auto Parts warehouse in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, as the GM strike drags on. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Few thought it would last this long. A nationwide strike by members of the United Auto Workers Union against General Motors is now entering its 5th week. At stake, a new 4-year contract. Dozens of GM factories have shut down. By some estimates, GM is losing at least $90 million a day. The strike is having a ripple effect across the economy, and as tens of thousands of workers remain off the job and on the picket line, in some places manning shifts 24 hours a day, lost lost wages are now in the hundreds of millions of dollars. This hour, we thought we'd ask what it is like to put your job and livelihood on the line by going out on strike. Close to home, about 90 GM workers at the parts distribution center in Langhorne are on the picket line. They include John Jane, Financial Secretary for the local UAW chapter. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having us.
And Raina Shoemaker has been employed at the Langhorne plant for 4.5 years. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
And before we get going, here's the email address for any who might want to join the conversation. It's radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. So let's talk first about the work that you do. Raina, what do you do at the warehouse in Langhorne? What's your job?
I fill orders for the dealerships that are pretty much from Delaware all the way up to the East Coast, all the way to Maine.
And when you say you fill orders, what does that involve?
We pick parts.
Lifting?
We lift parts. Yeah.
So a physically demanding job?
It's very physical.
Okay. John?
I'm on the inbound shift. I receive the parts off the trailers, and I make sure they're split up properly so they go to the right location so we don't have wasted movement, people going all over the warehouse. And the job is very repetitive. There's a lot of twisting, turning, lifting, pulling, pushing. So there are people constantly going out on sick leave and stuff like that.
Mm. And 8-hour shifts? Or longer?
Yes.
Usually longer.
Looking at me.
They're able to mandatory us an extra 2 hours each day, and they take advantage of that. We usually do about 10 hours.
Closer to 10. Okay. Mm-hmm. So assuming health insurance is a really big, you know, very important to you, as it is to most of us, but yeah, especially with a physically demanding job.
Yes.
I read earlier today that according to the Detroit Free Press, GM apparently is going to leave worker share of the cost for health insurance as is. It was at 3%. GM, I think, wanted to bring it up to 15%. But this is according to the Detroit Free Press, since it's the only place I've seen it, so I'm not really sure. I don't know if you've heard anything differently. But if this is the case, if this is what happens in the final contract, good deal?
Oh, yes. On the healthcare part, yes, that's great. That's a lot of people out there think, like, we always want more. A lot of times we just want to keep what we have. Mm. And for the company to be making $35 billion in the last 3 years and try to take away our healthcare, that's just, I thought that was crazy.
If you had to pay more into healthcare, Raina, what would that do to your bottom line at home?
Oh, it's a big impact. You know, we're already on different scales of pay as it is, and then you're going to also make you pay for healthcare. It's wrong.
Do you have families at home? Are you supporting people
mm-hmm.
at home?
Yes.
Yeah. Children?
I have three boys.
I also have three kids.
Yeah. So another sticking point is, I guess, the hiring of employees as temporary workers, which is something we see across the country and across the business world. Why is that a sticking point for you at GM?
I think that they take huge advantage of our temporary employees.
How so?
First, they don't pay them what they should. They're on the lowest pay scale. They make them feel like, even though they mandatory us overtime, they make them feel like they need to keep going until everything's finished. So they might put in 14-hour days, and it's very physical and it's demanding on your body. So they really beat them down. Like it's wrong what they do to them. They don't get the benefits that we get. They don't get profit sharing that we get or any bonuses. So they're really left in the dark with a lot of things.
And are these people who might be working the same job? You
exact
are
job.
Oh, okay.
The exact job.
Yeah, and that subject really hits home for a lot of us because we all started out as temporary employees. And it's crazy that you get no paid time off. Like, you're only allowed to take off three days a year. And what Raina was talking about, how they pretty much make you stay until work's done. Like, me having the three kids, like, I found a babysitter. My shift's supposed to be 3 to 11. And there's days I wasn't walking out of there until, like, 5 a.m. And then I have to go to the babysitter. The kids got school in the morning. And that's something that I think needs to stop. Like, I understand the reason why temporary employees are there for, like, the summer months, stuff like that. But when you start keeping them for a year, like, 2, 3, 4, 5, I hear places up to, like, 6 and 7 years. That's just
before
crazy.
They can actually become
right. Yes.
Full-time employees. Right. So what would you like to see for temporary workers?
A pathway to being hired.
They so the needed, pathway is what, like a couple years or a couple
well,
months?
Well, no, that's even too long. I mean, seriously, they know whether they need them or not.
Yeah,
really,
yeah.
A temporary employee should be for summer months to help out with when we have a lot of people on vacation. But if you're keeping them past that, then you know you need them. So if you need them, bring them on permanently. That's the way we feel.
John?
Yes, I totally agree with that. If you're constantly relying on this person to get the work done, then they should be made permanently. They should be reaping the same benefits as their fellow coworkers doing the exact same job.
Let's talk about walking the picket line. What is that experience like? Is it the first time for either both? Yes, you're
yes.
not. So
yes.
It's the first time for both of you.
First time for both of us.
John, tell us about being on the picket line. Which shift are you generally manning? And you guys are there 24
yeah,
hours a day,
we're
right?
there 24-7, okay. And sometimes I feel like I'm there 24-7. It was in the beginning, I didn't know what to expect. And so I was going out there doing what I was supposed to do. And then just the community support is like so great. Like,
really?
Yeah, it's so refreshing. And it brings energy to the picket line and stuff like that. I was amazed by how much community support we get.
Well, what does the community support look like?
Whether it's just someone coming out, hanging out with us for a couple hours, listening to our story, us listening to their story. A lot of times they bring like donuts, coffee, pizza. Like we get stuff delivered there all day long just from other unions and stuff like that in the community. It amazes me how much the community is involved.
Raina?
We also have an organization, DSA, that has organized food banks for some of our workers that, you know, they need some extra help. It's amazing. They just shop. They so much food they brought in for the families. And it's huge.
Are you
and
hearing so anything negative from people while you're on the picket line? And
no.
No?
Occasionally, but it's very far and few between. Like every once in a while you see someone drive by yelling something. But other than that, it's all positivity.
Still, it's been a month. I mean, you guys must be exhausted.
Yeah, I feel like I'm working more than I did when I was working.
So you do get a stipend from the union, correct? And I think
it just
bumped up, was it this past weekend?
Yes. Starting this week, it's now $275 per week. So the first check will come in next week for $275. We were getting $250 after the 15th day of striking. So far we got two checks for $250 and then $275 will start coming next week.
So helpful, but for the long run, Raina, no.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't help with the bills that much.
Yeah. How is this affecting your families at home? Mom and dad have to go out and, man, was it 6 hours? Are they 6 hours?
They're two 6 hour shifts.
Two 6 hour shifts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Plus, a lot of us want to be there for each other, so we're there longer than what we should.
Yeah. So at home, what are the kids asking?
I normally try to bring my kids out to the picket line. I think this is a great opportunity for them to see that when you feel like something is wrong, that you can stand up for it and changes will be made. They enjoy the picket line. They enjoy seeing the people. They enjoy seeing the coworkers. It's activity that I feel like is bringing us closer together. They also realize that daddy's not making the same amount of money he was. So they know on all financial fronts that it's a little bit tight.
And, I mean, how much longer do you feel you can go on in this way with $275 a week, I think you said, before you reach a critical point in your own lives, Raina?
I think I might be looking for a part-time job soon. I think a lot of us, the union has now said that we can subsidize that way, so we will.
Yeah, the necessary next step.
Sure. It'll make us stronger because now we're allowed to do it.
All right, we've got some comments coming in. Melissa asks a question. How is GM supporting single families? I'm not quite sure what that might mean, that, you know, from your end.
Well, I am a single father of three.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure what she's asking. I know at the picket line right now while we're on strike, there are food banks and stuff. Like, I am getting food from the community and stuff like that. I am getting help from other coworkers.
But not from the company.
Yeah, from company standpoint,
Okay. Email from Nick. Let's not forget that the 40-hour work week, workers' right to bargain, and other labor protections that many of us take for granted were one only one through massive sustained labor actions between 1933 and 1936. It's only since the 1970s that strikes have petered out and workers' pay and power have shrunk in direct proportion. Do you see a return to the glory days of the union, say back in the mid-20th century, returning to this country?
I hope so. I feel like unions do make the workforce, the middle class, stronger. Just being at my facility, I've been there for a little over 7 years, and I feel like just in that 7 year span, we're getting stronger as a union, as a local. So I'm not sure how it's working across the country, but I'm hoping that the same is going on at every facility in the country.
Well, let's talk about, the fact that I don't have to tell you guys that we live in a global society and that union jobs have been outsourced. Other automakers are watching these negotiations closely. What are the stakes here regarding bargaining power for unions in this country in the 21st century? What's at stake, Raina? Yeah, that's a hard question answer. You know,
it's one of the biggest things in stake is like job security and like just able to make a decent like wage off a decent job and be able to take care of your family. That's what most Americans, I feel like, want. They want to be able to live life with their family, enjoy their family, and be able to earn enough money to do that.
Mm. I mean, automakers in Mexico, I think, make just a couple bucks an hour, maybe $3 an hour. I guess the question I'm asking, and you probably don't have an answer because I don't have an answer, is how do you compete with that?
I think by doing what we're doing, we have to take a stand. The last strike only lasted just under 2 days, and GM had about 75,000 employees. Their profits are going up, their sales are going up, and this strike, we're striking about 48,000 employees. So right there, we lost 25,000 hour employee jobs, and that was in 2009. That wasn't even that long ago. So we have to take the stand so these jobs just don't keep leaving. We have to keep these jobs in America. We have to make sure GM gives us a commitment to keep these jobs here so we all could continue making a living.
They're an American company. They need to stay in America. That's, you can't keep saying I'm an American company and going elsewhere.
Yeah. Let's talk about quality control. I mean, do you feel that there is more quality control in this country?
Oh, absolutely. There's rules, regulations through many of organizations that take place in this country that other countries just don't abide by, whether it be like safety rules, safety regulations. I know Mexico is very far from us on that aspect.
Let's talk. Well, when you talk about regulations, for instance, what on your job, John, do you have to deal with to make sure that that workers are protected and that the quality of the product is top notch?
We focus a lot on the safety of our workers. Before we do any task, any new task, we go over certain guidelines. We point out like every aspect that you could get injured at. We make sure we have the proper safety equipment needed. And I'm not sure what goes on in other countries, but I know in America we try to keep safety at the forefront.
All right. So let's kind of look at politics, at least peripherally. You've had some Democratic presidential candidates who stopped by or even joined UAW picket lines across the country to show support. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren. There's no right or wrong answer here, but what do you want to see from your elected official, those in Congress and those in the White House, regarding this strike and the labor movement moving forward? John?
I want our elected officials just to remember, like, the middle class, remember their working class when they move forward on making policies. I do like seeing them be on the picket line and supporting us and stuff like that. I just got to make sure when they are elected or if they're elected now that their policies are helping out the working class.
NAFTA, of course, was renegotiated to the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. It has not been ratified at this point. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says, last I saw, the Democrats are on a path to yes, but there are concerns that the U.S.-MCA won't go far enough to stop companies from relocating to Mexico. Is this the sort of thing, are you encouraged by seeing these agreements renegotiated and also, you know, pulling out from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or is this something that makes you a little bit leery?
From what I hear about the new pact, there's still a lot of stuff that can be worked on. Hmm. It is a move in the right direction, but there's still a lot of aspects of it that could be changed to better protect the working people of America. I know there's a lot of guidelines in there that says, like, if this happens, then this happens, but there's no, like, policement, like, there's no enforcement of those rules. And that has to be in this agreement for it, I feel like, for it to work long term.
So back to your job. Raina, why this job? Why this industry for you?
Well, I actually started because my father, it was like I have fathers, uncles that all worked for General Motors. So it was just,
it's
felt right.
It's a legacy
right.
job.
Yeah, it actually felt right. And
can you see yourself doing anything else?
No, really not now. I mean, the people is what really makes it, you know. We are really strong now. We're like brothers and sisters. We're like a family now. So
walking the picket line has even strengthened you.
Oh, yeah. And
John, you're nodding too.
The people, a lot of people don't like their job, but they like the people, and that's what makes it good, you know.
John, why this job for you?
Raina touched on it. Like, I initially got this job. It's the first time I ever had a union job, so I didn't know what to expect. And the more and more I work at the job, the more and more I get involved with the union, it does feel more and more like a family. One thing that this strike has done is between first shift and second shift at work, we run two shifts. There's an hour break in between. So a lot of the first shift people never get to meet the second shift people and vice versa. And with this strike, we're meeting everybody. Like, we're starting to get meet people's families, their kids, their brothers and sisters are coming out. So it's bringing us a lot closer together. And I think that's the silver lining in this strike is how much stronger we're going to be when we get over this and we get the contract that we deserve.
Well, hopefully it all wraps up for you soon and that you're happy with how it's renegotiated. Okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Raina Shoemaker and John Jayne, who are on the picket line out in Langhorne at the GM warehouse there. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you.
Good luck to you. All right, and up in just a moment, we talk to the Reverend Renee McKenzie, who is vicar of the Church of the Advocate in North Philadelphia. Beautiful church in dire need of repair. She's going to talk about that here on Radio Times in studio. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Church of the Advocate in North Central Philadelphia has been an integral and beloved part of the community for well over 100 years. As described in a recent Billy Penn article, it's an architectural masterpiece, a Victorian cathedral covering 100,000 square feet, listed on the National Register of Historic Places in part because of the 14 murals which adorn the limestone walls, designed and painted by black artists in the 1970s. But the structure itself is in trouble, in desperate need of repair, with an estimated bill of a whopping $7 million. The Reverend Renee McKenzie is vicar and chaplain for the Church of the Advocate and is leading the effort to find the necessary funding. And it is with pleasure that we welcome the Reverend McKenzie to Radio Times. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Of course. Well, why don't we begin by talking about what the church means to the surrounding neighborhood. You are at, you're on Diamond near 18th, right?
We're at 18th and Diamond.
Okay.
And I always say that Temple University is on the campus of the Church of the Advocate.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah, we butt up to each other. We share the same community. The Church of the Advocate has been a hub of this community. And I'm going to go back. I mean, the structure was built in 1866. And it was intentionally put at this location because it was a growing industrial area. And there were a lot of workers coming in. And there was, of course, some concerns about whether or not they were being properly religiously educated. And so the George W. South family decided that they were going to build this church, this memorial to George W. South, right at this location. And the church has always seen itself as the advocate. I mean, it's always been the church of the advocate. So initially when it was built, it was the advocate for the people who were working in the community, people who were transplanted from other places. Mm-hmm. As the community started to transition from being a wealthy white community, which was circling right there at 18th and Diamonds, fairly wealthy community, it became an advocate for poor people, became an advocate for African-American people. It became an advocate for women. In our particular community, the advocate is a hub.
You feed people.
We feed people. We've been doing it for 36 years, 5 days a week.
And you also shelter people. I think you had an undocumented family from Mexico. Is the Hernandez family still
yes,
there?
Yes, Carmela and her four children. No, they're no longer with us. Okay. They're now at the Mennonite Church in Germantown. But they were with us for a year. And that feels completely like being the advocate, the fact that we just embrace and welcome people so easily. That's historically true.
So 8 years ago, Reverend McKenzie, you take the reins and you were handed a report outlining the urgent fixes. Tell us about that experience. You're shaking your head.
Well, you know, I look back at those, you know, when I started 8 years ago, I didn't have a clue about what I was walking into, frankly. I had no idea really about the history of the place. I certainly had no idea about the building needs of the place. And you're right, I received this really thick document that's been prepared, but it showed tremendous needs. They had tackled the first list of needs, which were the immediate needs, and they were the building envelope issues, things to keep the advocates safe and dry inside.
And like so
the roof, right. And so about 25 years ago, we had a new roof put down. But what's happening now? Now we're having some safety and security issues that need to be addressed because we're a historic sanctuary. I mean, we're not held to the same safety standards, right? But we would like to be there. We'd like to have push bars on the doors. We would like to have lighted exit signs. And we want to make sure that everything is up to code. So that's what we're looking at now. And then, of course, we have the long-term project. How do we make it beautiful again? Which is also a concern.
Yeah. Well, immediately, though, back to the roof, if you have a heavy rain, you've got issues. And also, too, you've got netting across the top of your gorgeous ceiling so that, parishioners are not hit by, chunks of plaster. So and the immediate fixes will cost, what, about $1 million, right?
Well, I think, the immediate fix will probably cost about $1 million. There are some, it's a gutter issue now with the roof. The roof is fine. It's okay. The roofing system. And that's what allows the water to infiltrate and pour right down in those 2 of the 14 murals.
Okay, that was the next question. The hand-painted murals, some of them are in danger. Tell us about those murals.
Those murals were painted between 1973 and 1976. Paul Washington, Father Paul Washington, who was the iconic, pivotal, he was a revolutionary figure in the city as well as nationally, internationally. But he commissioned these murals because somebody came into the Advocate and they asked Paul about, if this was a black church, why are there only white figures? I mean, we had the beautiful traditional European stained glass windows, incredible. But said, where is the black representation? And so Paul had these 14 murals put up, and they tell in great detail and with great beauty and passion the story of the African-American experience in this country. And so, and it portrays very clear the history of oppression as well as the acts of resistance to oppression.
Some of them aren't easy to look at.
Oh, some of them are not easy to look at.
Yeah. There's anger.
But they tell the truth.
Well, they do. They tell the truth. There is, there is anger.
There is.
There is some violence.
Yeah.
So when you are, you are in a church in which you're talking about healing and love in the Gospels, and somebody's, you're telling people about the murals, how do you reconcile that within your church?
Because I said it tells the truth, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at the stained glass windows, they have implements of war in them.
Mm-hmm.
But we're accustomed to seeing that, and we don't question that type of violence or depiction of violence in the church.
Well, Christ's death was violent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So what the murals simply do, they say, well, this is a contemporary experience of suffering and pain.
But it opens conversation.
And that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
But actually what it also opens, for African-Americans who go into this place, we don't often see our story so vividly told in such a location. So that's the connection, because this is our story. But I don't want it to make it seem like the advocate is just for African Americans.
It's for everybody.
1974, the first 11 women were ordained into the Episcopal priesthood at the Church of the Advocate.
Well, I just back to, I mean, you know, obviously a primary focus of your visit here today is to talk about this magnificent structure.
That's right.
Which is in need of repair. And back to the murals, when you find that some of those murals are actually endangered by water
by
that
water.
Might come in during a flood,
yeah.
That you must be gritting your teeth.
Yes. Hmm. It's hard. I mean, it's hard to witness that. But, you know, the challenge before us is because this place means so much and it represents so much beauty. And certainly, I would say that the Spirit of the Lord is ever present in the Advocate. You walk in and you feel it. It can be saved. It deserves to be saved. It deserves. When I came to the Advocate 8 years ago, I would go into groups of people and I would introduce myself. And if people were 50 and over, they had an Advocate story. The Advocate connected with them in some way. Younger generations, they didn't have it. I think that the story of the Advocate is our story. It's an American story. And we will be poorer off if we don't allow this story to live for, you know, successive generations.
So let's talk about the money. You know, as so many churches are finding, Reverend, getting the steady crowd in every Sunday, aside from the holidays, can
That's
be
right.
a real challenge.
Right.
And there is poverty in the neighborhood, so money in the plate's not going to do it. You have donors, correct? You almost lost a donor, I think, for the Advocate, the soup kitchen, correct? But that reconciled itself. So my point is, you must be walking around with a jar of Tums every day. Thinking
no.
about this, no?
I rely heavily on the Spirit, but I will tell you. Right, the Advocate, so we face some immediate challenges. Right, there was a threat that the cafe would close. We lost a major donor. But, you know, once we spread the word and let people know, people have stepped up. We had an immediate deficit of about $800 a month. That's for the cafe. That's the immediate deficit. And we need to match that in order to keep the cafe running. We have a part-time cook, and we serve about 500 meals a week, at least 500 meals a week. My congregation, on the other hand, has been historically small, between 30 and 40 people. And for some of the reasons you pointed to about it's the Episcopal style of worship in some ways is foreign to some aspects of the African-American community. And so there is not that immediate kind of grasping and finding their place. But that's the Episcopal Church's problem. That's not the community problem. So we need to learn how to communicate. But thank goodness the Advocate has partners.
So tell us about the partners.
Well, we have other Episcopal churches, mainline churches. They do come out and they support our cafe. And they, the Episcopal Diocese, they took a revolutionary step under the leadership of our bishop, Daniel Gutierrez, at our last convention. The convention said that recognizes that the Church of the Advocate is a national and local treasure. And so they're willing to invest time and money to get the Advocate on its feet again.
Really?
Yes. Now, in the history of the Advocate, there's never been this type of outpouring of generosity, right? The diocese has always supported us because we have never been able to pay our way. But it is this concentrated effort, this recognition that in these days, it is particularly important that a place like the Advocate remains.
So how far does this get you toward not only repair, but restoration of the building?
Oh, restoration of the building. That, when I say it's $7 million, mm-hmm. I ballpark that figure. That's complete restoration.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have the exact number. We have studies, but we haven't explored them at this moment. But I'm going to say it's probably between $5 and $7 million. But the Advocate will be beautiful. But
it sounds like you're optimistic that this money is, but I mean, are you there, or are you looking elsewhere to add to the effort to get the necessary structural repairs done and then the eventual restoration?
Well, we are far from there. So I am speaking in hope. I am speaking with hope because I believe it's going to happen. I know it's going to happen because I think that the world deserves it. I think that Philadelphia deserves it.
What do you need immediately?
We need partners. We need donors. You can log on to our website, churchoftheadvocate.org, and you can get more information about the history. If you look at my Facebook page, Renee McKenzie, however that's you do that in Facebook, you will see incredible photos that were taken recently about the Church of the Advocate, and they're outstanding. And you will see the intrinsic beauty of this place and how the evidence of the Spirit and the power of the people is present.
You obviously, you are a woman of God. I mean, do you ever find yourself despairing? We all do at times.
No, I. When the Advocate was getting ready to, when the cafe almost closed, and this happened while I was on sabbatical, when the cafe almost closed, I didn't get to despair. I got to anger and frustration because it wasn't time. So, no, I don't get to despair because I believe it's going to happen.
So let's talk about another fix that's needed. It might seem relatively minor, all things considered, but the acoustics are eroding. I mean, the church has been around well over 100 years, and the acoustics really lend something to the church experience, don't they?
We have classical musicians who love to come in and play and record in the sanctuary. It is the building, the sanctuary, apparently, from what I'm told, has five echoes. Now, I'm not a musician. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I do know that sound carries at a certain vibration, and it sounds incredible for a particular type of voices and instruments. Yes, it's in its incredible place. But for speaking, we need to tone the acoustics down a little bit. So we need that set up like they would have at the at where the orchestra plays. So you can dampen the sound.
I just wanted to get your thoughts as a pastor. How do we bring diverse peoples together in divisive times?
I think that's what the Advocate has been doing for a long time.
Different political backgrounds. I mean, there's so much tension.
Well, when we say different political backgrounds, and I say the Advocate has been doing that, on one hand, we would say that the Advocate's audience is probably people who are of the more radical nature. But the truth is the events that we have at the Advocate, orchestra events, plays, conversations, they cross boundaries. They cross the differences we may have in people. When Carmela's family was here, we had events going on in Spanish. I mean, that's bringing people together, trying to do something about this divisive place. The only thing we can do is work on relationships. And I say that that's the center of everything else.
How do you approach somebody who might believe diametrically opposed to yourself?
Yeah. Well, you can only have a conversation. At some point, you have to agree to disagree. There's no reason to bang your head against a wall and get frustrated because we don't know how to listen to each other.
Why this vocation for you, Renee McKenzie?
Oh, my goodness.
Do we need another hour?
I don't know. I was a physical therapist. I was as happy as a physical therapist, and God called me here. And actually, I received my PhD because I thought I was going to be a teacher. I had no intention of going into the church like this. I can't do anything else. This is who I am.
And the Church of the Advocate?
Church of the Advocate.
The place where you're meant to be.
Yes.
I'm making an assumption there, but you just confirmed it. Okay, so as we wrap up, once more, immediately, what would you like to see from our listening audience, if at all possible, in terms of support for the Church of the Advocate in order to restore it?
I would like for people to stay connected to the story at this point, because we'll be rolling out a larger campaign. But immediately, we do have a PayPal donation site set up. It's on our Facebook page, and it's also it's on our website. So if people are inclined to donate, we would certainly welcome that. If you would like to know more, have more information, if you want to come and take a tour, we want people to connect to the story and then take the story back out to their community.
Well, the Reverend Renee McKenzie, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Keep in touch. Let us know how it goes.
We'll do.
Reverend Renee McKenzie is vicar and chaplain for the Church of the Advocate in North Philadelphia. And as always, if you would like to connect with us here at Radio Times on social media, visit us at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.